Look, you have to tell people a lot of uncomfortable truths if you're going to be a good political satirist. If you want to be funny and important, then you've got to tell people the truth that, like, for example, the United States is a terrible country. You know, I mean, just awful. And that we have no business talking down to anyone else.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, and thank you for joining us to discuss the future of satirical cartooning. Tonight's event comes on the heels of the loss of yet another newspaper cartoonist, Rob Rogers, who was fired last week from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He had been there for 25 years as their editorial cartoonist, and he said, I quote, "After so many years of punchlines and caricatures, skewering mayors and mullahs, the new regime at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette decided that the Donald trumped satire when it came to editorial." Rogers attributed the loss of his job directly to Trump and the fact that as a cartoonist, he had failed to follow the newspaper's directive to echo the politics of the Republican publisher. And so, this is where we find ourselves. The battle for free expression and independent opinion continues in a country where the president has declared that the free press is one of the greatest threats. This siege is no longer being fought elsewhere in the offices of Charlie Hebdo, the satirical newspaper in Paris, which was targeted by Islamic extremists. No, it's being fought here and now in the US daily, in every decent newsroom in the country. I am Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are extremely honored to have with us a man whose bad boy reputation precedes him. I speak, of course, of Ted Rall, a living, kicking cartoonist who's here to talk about the role and craft of the political cartoonist. So let me begin first with a Ted Rall quote. "Political cartooning may not pay well, or often at all, and media elites can ignore it all they want, but it matters, almost enough to die for." Ted Rall is a syndicated cartoonist whose work appears in 100 newspapers around the United States. He draws 3 editorial cartoons a week, in addition to writing a weekly syndicated column. He's editor-in-chief of the satirical news website skewednews.net. In addition to his 4 successful pictorial biographies about Ed Snowden, Bernie Sanders, Trump, and now Pope Francis, he's written about topics as diverse as international politics, popular culture, privacy, and generational politics. I'm delighted to introduce the talented and always opinionated Ted Rall.
One of the things that this disruption has forced us to do and has made the difference between the 16 of us who are still around and the hundreds who are not is adaptability and trying new things and trying to figure out new ways to reach the public. And in my case, I started working in the graphic novel form and comics journalism form back in the mid-90s because it just seemed like really cool and there was stuff you could do that you couldn't do in other formats. And a few years ago, I sort of blundered into what I'm doing these days, which is I'll keep doing until I get tired of them, the graphic novel biography format. I was necessarily critical. I think it's sort of inherent to the idea of editorial satire is that you're constantly making fun of people. And, you know, I dug out my first grade report card the other day, and the comment from the teacher written in pencil in 1968 said, Frederick, which is my legal name, said, "Frederick has an uncanny ability to hone in on each child's Achilles heel and reduce him or her to tears." It's like, and I have to say, when I read that, I was not ashamed. I think Miss Taylor was extremely perspicacious and perceptive. So the thing is, the one of the things that I tried to do, and like I was constantly being told and complained about, and my fans would say, why don't you ever do anything positive? Don't you have any heroes, any role models? People at Q&As would say, like, who's your favorite president? And I'm like, well, they're all scum, so none. Sorry. And I mean, I love history. I know they're all scum. Then, like, the Edward Snowden story broke in 2014. And I thought, like, you know, here's a guy who actually did the right thing. Here's a guy who, he fits every bill of what Ted Rall looks for in a hero. A person with integrity, who takes chances, who does the right thing, even though it's going to hurt him or her personally. And so I thought, this is a story I really want to tell. And I think I wanted to tell the story in a non-pedantic way. I didn't want to say, okay, so if you're working at, say, these days, ICE, you should quit and steal documents and give them to the media. You should, actually. That's the moral thing to do. But I wanted to just sort of tell the story and be like, where'd this guy come from? Like, why did he make this decision? Like, you know, what was it that made, you know, at the time, there were tens of thousands of people who saw the same documents, and they sat on them. And they went home every day to their children and their spouses and their partners and kissed them and went to bed and had sex, and they thought they were good people. And then Edward Snowden's like, no, this is wrong. And he was a right-winger. He started out as a right-winger. He's like, I'm gonna change this up. I'm going to take a new direction. I'm going to flee, and I'm going to go on the lam, and I'm going to, and even if they kill me, that's fine. So why was he different? So I sought to answer that question, and so I did this biography, which is still kind of the only Edward Snowden biography, really, and it was successful, and so, in other words, it sold lots of books. It doesn't mean that it was any good, but it was successful, because we live in capitalism, and so when you're successful, your publisher always comes back and says, like, do you have another one just like that, but better, more successful? So around the same time, I sort of did the Hail Mary pass. Bernie Sanders had just announced for president, and I just had a very strong instinct about him because I had been following his career for all of my life, and I just thought he was a fascinating character, and I thought his, you know, he was like the guy who'd been telling the same story that the country was finally catching up to, and I was like, well, I told my publisher, look, this is either going to go gangbusters or it's going to die a dog's death because he's going to drop out of the primaries like in March. So, but let me do it. And he was like, let's just do it. And it became a New York Times bestseller. It was, a very successful. My publisher was very pleased. And so then we were like, so who should be next in our trilogy of positive change makers? So naturally we turned to Donald Trump. That's not really true. Pope Francis is the real. We did a little detour, and I kind of symbolized that with the black cover of the Trump book, which also looks a little different from the other ones. It's a homage to one of Hitler's election posters from 1932, where it's just a photo of Hitler on a black background that just has Hitler across. So I'm trying to signify that, like, I don't really like this guy. But I was also trying to give the devil his due and tell this story. It's a very different approach because a proper biography of Trump in this format would have to be 2,000 pages long because he's had a very long history and there's a lot to document. I mean, you know, Edward Snowden was 29 when he stole all that stuff. He hadn't done that much. He never even graduated from high school. So it's kind of like a completely different kind of narrative. So with Trump, that's more of an extended editorial cartoon, and it's kind of focusing on some key stories. And it didn't do as well because Ted Rall fans don't like Donald Trump. Donald Trump fans don't like Ted Rall. My publisher was, so then he's like, okay, we got to go back to doing the positive ones. So I'm like, so we're like, who? It's, I mean, by the way, what does it say about our system that it's so hard to come up with good people? And so I had to import one from Italy by way of Argentina. So Pope Francis was like, it seemed like a good choice because he was coming up, by the time the book came out, it was going to be the fifth anniversary of his papacy. And I just thought, like, you know, there was a lot of hubbub about him the first year or two after he ascended to he was named pontiff. But then kind of people sort of started taking him for granted. And I thought, well, you know, that's kind of wrong. He's a remarkable dude. And because he kind of violates one of my core principles, which is that words aren't enough. You know, I mean, like, to me, like, politics is in the street, I grew up in when I was a little kid, it was the 60s and early 70s. I mean, to me, that's where activism takes place. And just talking doesn't do it. It's like, it's not enough. But maybe if you're Pope, you know, it's different. Like, so when the Pope says that, like, gay people aren't bad, that is big. You know, when the Pope says that a huge category of people have been wronged and redress needs to be made, that's important. When the Pope addresses climate change, it means more. Not to say that he was the first Pope to address climate change, that's not true. But when he says it, it means more. So what I was interested in as I delved into Pope Francis's story was, you know, kind of like where he came from. And then very quickly, I realized that for me, the big story was going to have to be the dirty war in Argentina. And that, to me, it ended up becoming a really, I read this one story that just, as I was raised Catholic, that just made me completely, made the book come together. You know, when you write or draw a book, it's often hard to find a way in, is the best. I just recently read Seymour Hersh's excellent autobiography called Reporter, and he was talking about how it's hard to find a way in to a story or a book sometimes. And then it either just dies a dog's death or it clicks. And for me, what clicked with Francis was this narrative of these two Jesuit priests who were working in the barrio, and the junta came to him and demanded that he pull these priests out of the barrio because that was considered liberation theology. It was socialist. The junta was right-wing. So he defrocked these two priests, and they lost their protection of the Catholic Church, and they were kidnapped and nearly killed. They were tortured almost to death, drugged, barely made it out, and then actually Francis did intercede to get them out before they were killed. And it chastened him, and the Jesuit order in Argentina really turned against him, and they were furious. And to this day, it's not all forgiven by any means. So even though he's the first Jesuit pope, he's like not Mr. Popular among the Jesuits. But nevertheless, he has spent most of his life trying to atone in some respect and moving to the left politically for that action. And most notably, he went to celebrate mass. He showed up unannounced with the two priests, the two victims, and he prostrated himself in front of everybody and begged forgiveness there. And he was the cardinal at the time, of Buenos Aires. This was a big deal. And I thought, where are the American leaders like that? You know, I mean, really, truly, I mean, you could name any single one, man. They have a lot of apologies to make. Like, you know, God, Trump needs to live to be like 300 to do all the apologies. But I would say the same about all of them. And, you know, I just thought, like, well, that's integrity. And I thought, you know, as a Catholic, I just went immediately to the sacrament of confession, which is the major defining difference between the rites of Catholicism and non-Catholic Christian sects in the United States. It's the one thing. It's penance is different. It's you confess, you beg for mercy, you apologize, you atone, and you try to make it right. That's a big part of, even though I don't believe in God anymore, I still believe in that. And I think that's a really important thing I think it's basically human ethics. And he did that. And I just thought, so the Francis' story is kind of the story of what Catholicism is all about. So that's how the book kind of came together for me. I realized that while I was working on it and people were talking to me about the book, they're like, well, you know, I don't know that much about Catholicism, a lot of like non-Catholics told me. And I was like, you know, I'm going to have to kind of do a tutorial. Then at the same time, you know, tell Francis's story and do it all in like 240 pages with like a lot of pictures. You know, it's very condensed for sure. It's like a dark star. But I think, you know, I think it worked out well. I'm really happy with the way it worked out. I don't know yet if it's going to be successful, but I'm currently working on actually another book. It's about Aaron Swartz, the Reddit person who committed suicide after he hacked into the JSTOR databases because he believed information and particularly academic papers needed to be free. And so that was kind of assigned to me by my publisher. I'm a little hesitant about how to get into this story because he did commit suicide, and that's not a positive change maker example that we need anyone to follow, obviously. But at the same time, he was a really interesting, troubled young man. And just because someone comes to an untimely end doesn't mean that their story is not worth telling or that they should be disappeared like a Soviet apparatchik from the top of Lenin's tomb on May Day. You know, I think he deserves a good biography, so hopefully I'll give him one. So, but the thing about these books is I've kind of found a niche. And I think that with any kind of person trying to survive in media these days, I don't really care about what kind of media it is, not just journalism or satire, you really need that. You need to figure out something that's, you can't just do what everyone else does. When I started drawing cartoons, almost every editorial cartoonist in America drew somewhat like Jeff McNelly, the cartoonist at the Chicago Tribune, or Pat Oliphant, the Australian cartoonist, who was widely syndicated, and they called it the Olinelli style. And you know it if you were around back then. It's like lots of cross-hatching, donkeys, elephants. There's a particular look. McNelly always loved like big, complicated objects like machines, like tanks or aircraft carriers, and they looked so cool. And he would just draw them like he didn't even have like a photo reference. They were just like out of his crazy brain. And he was just like, it was crazy. He also did like, he was very prolific. He also had a comic strip called Shoe. But anyway, everyone was trying to copy him. And Mary mentioned my Pulitzer finalist ship, right? Well, the reason that was a finalist ship and not a winner is because, and I've never told this story in public, but Columbia University, which awards the Pulitzers, they literally, so they sent up three finalists, and it was me and two other guys, and I'm going to say guys because, frankly, most political cartoonists are men, unfortunately. And the other two guys had previously won, and back then there was an informal rule that they didn't want to give repeated Pulitzers to anyone who'd previously won. So my friends all called me. They heard I was a finalist. They're like, congratulations, Ted. Champagne was delivered to my house. And so for about 6 hours, on a Tuesday in April 1997, I was a Pulitzer winner. And then Seymour Topping, the dean of journalism at Columbia University, stepped in and was like, no. Ted Rall doesn't draw like a political cartoonist. Ted Rall, it's like you have to draw like in the Olinelli style. He draws different. And he was like, ixnay. So literally they pulled Jim Morin's name out of thin air. He hadn't even applied. And they gave it to him, which they can do. There's all sorts of weird shenanigans on the Pulitzers. And you know, I for years I was incredibly bitter about that. And as you can tell, I'm completely over it now. But it is true that I would not be standing here today if he had not done that. Because if I had drawn like these other guys, I would have won a Pulitzer. And like those guys, I would be unemployed today. Because all the people who drew exactly the same are done. All the people who have unique drawing styles and have unique approaches are still around. And so I think originality still is the most important thing. I don't care what field you're working in. There's a huge drive for conformity. But conformity is not just like, it's not just boring, it's actually career suicide and in an age of disruption. And we're in an age of disruption.
Well, you are listening to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square as we continue our discussion of From Trump to the Pope, Inside the Mind of a Political Cartoonist with celebrated columnist and cartoonist Ted Rall. So your background was engineering and nuclear physics.
Right.
What advice do you give to a young, aspiring satirical cartoonist?
Don't major in applied physics and nuclear engineering. Actually, best advice I would give is study history. I think history is missing from the context of a lot of political satirists. They can't draw on it. And it's very unusual, right? I mean, if you think about like satire in other countries, there's always a historical context. I mean, like China's an extreme example. They have these satirical puppet shows and and funny cartoons that draw on stuff that happened 4,000 years ago. But like even in, like say in England, if you think of Monty Python, there's all these historical references. It's really rich. And, you know, just even being able to say, hey, this happened before, really helps you. I mean, America is the most ahistorical society, I think, on earth. You know, people don't even remember what happened 5 years ago. So if you're even able to say, like, well, you know, actually, Obama deported more people from the U.S.-Mexico border than all other U.S. presidents combined, and that's true. They're like, really? It's like you can say, well, look, or like when people say, like, oh, you know, separating kids from their families, that's not the American way. I'm like, really? Never heard of slavery? It's like, you never heard of what happened to the Native Americans having their babies ripped away from them? I mean, this is like, so if you have that knowledge of history, it really helps you, as opposed to just being able to, just being like, it is sad when kids are crying, which is unfortunately what a lot of, like, you know, commentary boils down to. So my best advice is study history or read history. Just read it.
So when you were a smart aleck at school, did you have any friends?
The answer is sometimes none at all, and sometimes everybody. It just depended on the context. It's kind of like how Bernie Sanders was a weirdo from Vermont until suddenly he's like the most popular politician in America, which he is today. You know, it's if the times catch up to you, if you're in the right place. In high school, I was wildly popular. In elementary school, I was completely ostracized. But I went to kind of a hillbilly high school, elementary school. So, you know, we're like having brown hair was unusual. It's like Village of the Damned. Everyone was blonde. And it was kind of freaky. And again, I'm completely over that now. But no, I was. It was definitely. It depends. It just depends. I think if you have, if you rely on satire for, if you're a jokester, and you're a prankster, people love you or they hate you, and that's just how it is. And it, like, you know, if you, I was kind of like really taken by this, this friend of mine who was a huge fan of George Carlin one time. You guys are going to totally, this isn't live, right? You're totally going to like bleep me out because I'm going to drop an F-bomb. So George Carlin had, my friend said like she loved George Carlin. She'd loved him for years, bought all his albums, seen him in concert many times. And then one time he told a joke that just pissed her off so much that she just decided he was dead to her. And I said, well, of course, I was like, I have to know what this joke is. And here's the joke. The joke is, have you ever noticed that women who are against abortion are women you wouldn't want to anyway? Okay, and the point is, I was like, okay, I'm not even going to judge whether that joke crosses any kind of line. Let's just stipulate it's disgusting and misogynist and sexist and lookist. Stipulated. But still, I was like, this guy's like on a high, comedy's a high wire act. I mean, you know, he's telling thousands of jokes a year. It's like the guy like screws up one time and he's dead to you? And she's like, yes. And I was like, then I'm dead. Like, and so I stopped caring. It was like, and if you care, you're just like not, you know, you can't do your job. But if you don't care, you're eventually going to get fired and ostracized and hated. When you go into this, it's like, you know that. It's a suicide pact.
So this kind of conundrum exists in your head because in order to take something apart, you have to be able to be a kind of a litmus test for society's conscience. You almost have to be able to read the national pulse. Yeah. And so you have to really be at heart an idealist.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, like, look, you have to tell people a lot of uncomfortable truths if you're going to be a good political satirist. You know, if you want to be popular and make millions of dollars, then you have to be Jay Leno. But if you want to be funny and important, then you've got to tell people the truth that, like, for example, the United States is a terrible country, you know, I mean, just awful, and that we have no business talking down to anyone else. You know, we're a shining city in a toilet, you know, and like people don't want to hear that because it's like, hey, this is the country I live in and I pay taxes and it kind of sucks to live in a, you know, to be like a, you know, a good German in Nazi Germany. But that's the reality. And, you know, you just can't care. And people are going to like you or they're not. I mean, like, I went through really rough times after 9/11. You know, when 9/11 happened, I was riding spectacularly high. I was in Time, Fortune, Forbes, Bloomberg magazine. I was in over 200 newspapers. And literally on 9/11, I was on my way to Philadelphia to pick up a $5.5 million check to start a Brooklyn alternative weekly newspaper. So I was riding high. then, like, within weeks, it all started to fall apart. My editor at Time called and said, we're not running humor anymore because no one will ever want to laugh again. The guy in Philly, the investor, said, no one will ever do business in New York again. And I was like, they do business in Hiroshima. And then it's like, you know, I mean, there's just like, it's just like Fortune like fired all their cartoonists. Everybody was out of work. The syndicates were getting like just overrun with cancellations. And it took 10 years to just start to crawl back. Never, of course, got close to it the way it used to be. And it's like never going to be in like big publications. Like those publications don't print any cartoonists. It's not like they don't like Ted Rall. They just don't like cartoons. So it's, you know, you're sort of like, things can change just like that, you know? Just think, you know, Peter Max was a big deal one day, and then suddenly he wasn't. And that's kind of like, that's what like art is. Like if you're a novelist or a poet or an actor even, it's like, you can just fall out of fashion. You're disposable. You know, American culture is not like, we're not like the French, you know, where Johnny Hallyday was like worshipped forever. You know, I love France. It's like, you know, it's not like that here. You're just, you know, but it's the only thing I ever loved doing. So that's why I do it.
Okay, so we established that you're sort of an idealist.
Totally.
But you call yourself a subversive. So do you think that's really important to have in democracy, subversives?
You know, there's always a dominant paradigm in any kind of society. And it relies on certain shibboleths that are some true, others not so true. And if you don't have a cast of people who are satirists and just social critics and activists and anarchists and people who are trying to undermine or criticize, like, first of all, that society can't be vibrant and can never even reform itself. But it's doomed, really, to revolution in the future. But even aside from that, if you don't have that, like, I think there's no hope for improvement in the future. I mean, the powers that be don't wake up in the morning and, like, you know, there's even, like, the, you know, like, Democrats in Congress, they don't wake up in the morning and think, there's tons of people sleeping outside every night, and this is America. They don't give two blankety blanks. They don't care. They don't care. They might care in some abstracted way, but they don't care, like, the way you care, like, when your bills are, like, unpaid. Like, you care. It's so that's up to people, you know, that's up to us to raise hell and call their attention to this stuff. Otherwise, nothing's ever going to get better, ever. Honestly, it's like satirists, and I'm not saying this about myself, although it's self-interested. I mean, I'm a fan of this medium that I'm in, and it has endless potential. I mean, can you imagine, for example, if, like, say, powerful media outlets like NPR and the New York Times and CBS News put, like, people who were, like, on the far left critiquing society on the air and in print, in drawings, routinely, it would broaden the conversation, and it would just, and on the far right, by the way, and it would just allow the full spectrum of ideas to be exposed and discussed. In fact, but instead we're in this, like, really narrow-casted band of self-censored, bland, middle-of-the-road, DNC, DLC, centrist, corporatist, not good for society. It's not even really good for, say, the Democratic Party. It's not even good for these media outlets. I guarantee you that print media wouldn't be in as much trouble today if it wasn't as boring.
Thank you. You have been listening to From Trump to the Pope, Inside the Mind of a Political Cartoonist, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with Ted Rall, the celebrated cartoonist. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us, and please come again.